It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
I got to tell you, I loved your friend Bob.
Wasn't it fun to have him?
I really enjoyed that guy.
I almost had to carry him out of here. He was going to just stay and do podcasts, I think, for the rest of his life.
I think he fell in love with podcasting, didn't he?
He thought it was a ball, and the feedback from people so immediately and people that were so encouraged by some of what he shared on both podcasts. So, yeah, he loved it. And but I had to take him back to the airport, so he said he'd come back anytime we wanted to fly him in. So,
hey, well, we'll see.
Well, fortunately, though, we did have him for a question that was brought up on the forum, something Bob said in the first podcast. And before we get on to tonight's stuff, maybe we ought to listen to that exchange a
little more
bit.
Bob.
I had a chance to talk to him before he left.
Well, we got a note from Dan, and fortunately, we got it in enough time that we can actually pose the question to Bob before he leaves. Bob was even thinking about getting Brad over here for another podcast tonight, but we just
I really enjoyed these. You know?
He's been having a ball with this. But after our last one, we talked a little bit, Bob, about... You know, God saying to us, the account in the Talmud about what did you do with the life that I gave you? And did you enjoy the life I gave you? And what Dan was saying is, I like that, because here in the West, God has given us so much that we could easily miss the wonderful life he gave us and fill it with the pursuit of empty things. So that works well for me. But I was thinking of the child born blind with AIDS in South Africa whose parents die before they are three and the child dies at the age of four. How are they to respond to that question from God? I mean, it was a nice, happy thought for those of us who are living happy lives, but what if your life is not so blessed?
Well, it's a great question, and I wish we'd raise it ourselves, but that's the fun thing about a podcast. You can get
about this conversation.
Yeah, you can get things from other people, and I my first comment, you asked me about this yesterday, and I said, I let me think about it. I don't know whether I even have a comment about it, because it's a... You know,
I like what you said. You said it was good for us to be reminded of that side of it, too.
It really is. I mean, there and many, many, in fact, most of the people in the world, unfortunately, not the people who listen to this podcast, but most of the people in the world are wake up every morning to the same thing. They woke up with great struggles. They don't have access to health care. Okay. They don't have they're people that are in isolated places who don't have opportunities for fellowship and all the rest. And I guess comment about coming before God and saying, did you enjoy it? First of all, there are those things that are common to all people that can be enjoyed. The fact that we live, the fact that we know God, those things are can be enjoyed by all people. So that much we know. And then the way that people that are very poor enjoy families in ways sometimes that people in the West don't understand.
Yeah, I've been to Durban, South Africa township outside Dazuma, and there are kids here without parents. They've already died of AIDS. Kids may be infected with AIDS. In a township, dirt poor, no running water, nothing. And watch kids run and play and laugh in the street. I mean, we get a false notion sometimes of these, you know, postcard moments when people are trying to pull at our heartstrings and send us money, that life's just every day miserable. And that's not true.
It's not true at all.
There is joy, even in the midst of great need.
Yeah.
And I think when we talk about enjoy the life that I gave you, we're not really talking about enjoying the way this world out of sync with its creator destroys it. It's not celebrating that.
No.
But celebrating the life we got glimpses of God while we were here in the midst of that.
And we don't always have to take this to its lowest common denominator. We can think in terms of a person that's very, very sick or whose family has all passed away from AIDS. And we can see them in the context, too, of others in the church who have taken those people and embraced them and loved them. I think about Helen Keller, for instance. That's, you know, the woman was deaf, she was blind, and yet Mrs. Sullivan, who took her and taught her and taught this woman who her only sense was smell and touch, nevertheless embraced life and enjoyed life in the fullest. It took ingenuity, but it also took the care of another to open doors for her enjoyment and understanding and perception without sight, without hearing, but perception nevertheless of the goodness of God. And Helen Keller was a tremendous believer in the divine presence, although she didn't say it the way evangelicals would, and she wasn't, you know, she wasn't a Methodist or a Baptist. Nevertheless, she spoke openly of her relationship with God and could at the end of the day say, I enjoyed it.
Well, I thought that was insightful.
You know, we sometimes think about enjoyment in our own context.
Well, we think about it circumstantially as if, you know, gee, did I get all the blessings that way? And life's a whole lot richer and more relationally focused, I think, in that question.
That's what I loved about Dan's question to begin with, was it really says, oh my goodness, let's move outside the temporal. Let's think about, brothers and sisters, that, you know, in terms of enjoyment, the way we first think of it, not going to have it in that sense because of the great oppressive need in their lives. But it doesn't mean God can't still make himself known at the depth of it.
Well, yeah, enjoyment isn't just about, you know, circumstantial material stuff. It's more like, you know,
freedom from suffering.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily that.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think there's a life that is rich in God that hasn't been deeply acquainted with pain and suffering as well. I think those are two sides of a coin you're not going to escape.
At the same time, we live in the West, obviously, very privileged lives. And having that, like we said at the end about someone that would love Helen Keller enough to help her find a way to communicate. I mean, there's people and there's ways we can infect the world around us with what God's given us to turn around and be a blessing in other people's lives who don't have near as much as we do. And that's an important reminder in this kind of dialogue.
Yeah, I think you look at the whole proverbial question of, you know, where is God in the midst of difficulty, pain, adversity? And we kind of got someone that wrote a book that might touch on that a little bit, huh?
Well, I've been talking about the book for a long time. And I know a lot of people probably haven't had a chance to read it yet because they're just kind of getting out.
They're just now arriving in the mail.
But obviously we're talking about The Shack again. And we've asked Paul Young, the author of that, William Paul Young, to join us tonight.
All right, we're doing something super techie today. We have remote location. We've invited the author of The Shack.
And he's on the other side of a quasar somewhere, it sounds like.
Yeah, there's some Skype stuff problems. You'll hear them.
Internet mosquitoes, you
know. I call them internet mosquitoes. Try to swat them if you can.
So we want to welcome to the microphones, Paul Young.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
Hey, is it Paul or Willie? I'm really confused.
even my kids are confused.
Well, the book cover says William P. Young, and we're calling you Paul, so we got to explain that, don't we?
It's part of the family tradition that actually shows up in the book, and my name is William Paul Young, and my dad is William Henry, and my firstborn is William Chad, and we all go by our middle names. So if as you read the book, you'll realize in the early stages of that shows up there. So what happened was, and not only that, Kim, who I'm married to,
That'd be your wife. That's not William Kim, is it?
No. She, her dad lived with us for almost 18 years before he passed a couple years ago. And his name was Willard, but he always went by Willie. So you put all those things. And when I started writing the book, originally it was going to be by Mackenzie Allen Phillips with William Paul Young. And
some nasty editor got in your way?
No, actually, there were a couple guys that read early drafts that almost got on airplanes to come up and visit Mackenzie Allen Phillips.
Yeah, so how is Mac doing?
So it's a main character, and people wanted to come and talk to him. And he doesn't exist, sort of. So we decided to scrap the idea of having it written by Mackenzie Allen Phillips with William Paul Young. But by that time, in the first edition, because it was ghostwritten supposedly by me, I'd already signed copies as Willie just to keep that idea. So we kept that part of it. We just changed the authorship.
So tell me, what inspired this book, Paul? What kind of came together in your life to write this thing?
And I could answer that a couple different ways.
And for people who are listening in, we're not going to give away plot points here because
we know
a lot of people haven't begun to read it yet. So we're not really talking about the book so much as the background of the book. But tell me, what inspired this? What got you to write this?
A couple things. One is Kim has been after me for about 10 years to write something for our kids. And it basically was, you really need to write something to help your kids understand how you think, you know, because you think kind of oddly or strangely or outside the box or however you want to put it. So she was impotent. I never wrote this with any thought to publish it. I never did. Right from the very beginning, I didn't. And so even now, I'm more than amazed about the whole journey that this thing has started to take us on. And I'm overwhelmed in a positive way by it. And it's sure a lot of fun, but totally unexpected. And frankly, I like that. I like the fact that I had no vested interest in the writing of this thing for any point of identity. I didn't see myself as an author. I did, you know, I've written lots of little things like poems and songs and short stories, but they were all for friends and family. I don't have some baggage that I think some people might have to deal with, because I didn't expect any of this at all.
So you didn't set out to be an author?
No, and I still don't think that I am.
Okay, look at the cover of the book again.
I know, I keep looking at the cover going...
Take it a little, will you? Because I think everyone else thinks you are.
Oh, I guess so. Well, people think that I'm a lot of things, not just an author.
And when Oprah calls and asks you if you're the author, you tell her, yes, I am, okay?
Oh, I will.
Okay, good.
All right.
I'll say, Wayne told me to answer this.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, this story is fiction, but in the sense that you didn't really have this experience, the core experience of this book. So where did this come out of? This is not really a life story in that sense, or is it?
Not in exactly that sense. A couple different things, and I'll again come at it two different ways. The first one is that we went through a really difficult 6 months early in our marriage, where we had three deaths, three immediate family deaths, and neither of us had death that close to us before. One was my 18-year-old brother, who was killed in Vancouver, British Columbia, actually in Burnaby, and he was on his first day on a job, and he got behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler, and as he went down the hill, which is about a 2-mile hill, the brakes failed, and there was a 4-lane major highway at the bottom of that 2-mile stretch, and with a light right where he would cross. And so he just laid on the horn instead of jumping out. It was a residential area.
Oh, wow.
And he went through that 4 lanes doing, they say, between 95 and 100 miles an hour. And then it went down another little dip through a log barrier, and he flipped upside down in the Fraser River and drowned in the bottom.
Oh.
And then... just a short time later, Kim's mother had a massive heart attack at the age of 59. And then just a month or two later, my 5-year-old niece was killed in the alleyway behind their house, backed up over by a cement truck of the company that my brother-in-law worked for, who was delivering cement to their house. So those three losses, by the time that Jennifer died, we were pretty much basket cases. Kim was she couldn't even go to the funeral. It was just too much. Those tragedies, we know something about loss in those. The second thing is that I brought to this whole story some history of my own. In many respects, I lost my own childhood because of some abuse stuff that occurred when I was a child. Actually, quite a bit of abuse.
And yeah, your real story would make quite a novel, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it may one day. Who knows? It was pretty brutal, and it began when I was 4 and 5 years old, and it wasn't immediate family. So,
and part of your thinking then, differently, aren't you what they call a third culture kid as well?
That is true. Missionary kids, diplomats' kids, army brats. Children whose parents work for multinational corporations, kids that grow up and have an exposure to more than one culture are called third culture kids, TCKs. And there's a lot of work that's been done over the years. You know, back when I was a kid, we were just missionary kids. And in my particular denomination, we were the missionaries are the top of the totem pole, and missionary kids are fairly rebellious because... of having to live up to a lot of expectations, I suppose.
Is that better or worse than a pastor's kid?
Well, I was both, so...
You were better and worse.
Doubly
worse. Oh, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so I had all everything stacked against me.
Paul, for some that don't know, where did you grow up? Where were your folks stationed?
I grew up in what was the Netherlands, New Guinea. It was a Dutch colony. It was the west half of the island of New Guinea, which is the second largest island in the world. It's right above Australia. Now it's commonly referred to as West Papua. There's a lot of turmoil in that country, but that's where I grew up.
And didn't you grow up in a in a tribe of cannibals?
Yeah, that's true.
That's a little different.
That is a little different, although when you're a child and you're growing up that way, you think that, you know, it's normal. And the tribe is, their name is Dani, which is D-A-N-I, and they were in the highlands, halfway basically between the coast and... There's actually some glaciers up in the central mountainous area. We were the first white people, our family, which was my mother and my father and myself. I was a year old when we went into that culture that had never seen a white person before us.
Wow.
And New Guinea is a very interesting, it has hundreds of different dialects that are totally unrelated to each other. You can have our dialect right next to the Damal dialect, which is a tonal language, and the differences are as different as, say, English and Chinese in the same country.
Wow.
And so we were among the Dani people, which was a large, you know, tribe spread out over 100 square miles, maybe. And they were animistic, warring, but fun-loving, but, you know, tribal warfare all the time, lots of feuds but basically, technology-wise, they were Stone Age. You know, the mentality a lot of times back then was, you know, as missionaries, if you give your life to God and you do the missionary work, then, you know, God will watch over the children and take care of the children. And so I spent most of every day as a Dani, not as a Canadian, which I am, or a white person. And, in fact, I didn't even really realize that I wasn't a Dani until I went to boarding school, which was kind of a shock.
So what ages were you there with that tribe?
I was there from age 1 to almost age 10. And we had one furlough in there, a break where we came back to Canada. And other than that, that was where I grew up. I went to boarding school, flew out starting at age 6, and I would be gone for 4 months. And then back home basically for 2 months, and then off again for 4 months. And boarding school was, as far as the abuse was no better than where I was coming from, as far as amongst the people. So
how was your own God journey playing out through all this, Paul? I mean, as a young man, do you remember having hungers for God? Was God just part of this big messy life you had? I mean, just where was your own journey and hungers through all that?
Very intense, as far back as I can remember, and that is that God was the only person, somehow, through all of this, that I absolutely trusted. Not that I was totally honest with, or that I ran to Him properly, or any of those other things, but I never doubted His character as being good. I doubted my character as being worthy to be around Him, but that's a whole different thing. But I remember being very young and just hanging on to my relationship with God because it basically became the only constant in my life. I mean, I grew up in this culture, I'm yanked away, go to Canada, come back to this culture, then go to boarding school. Then in the middle of third grade or whatever it was, got yanked out of the whole culture, dropped back into Canada, not knowing why. And then having to adapt to the West and all its technology and everything else that I didn't know about, and trying to fend through and make it through all of that, and dealing with everything that I dealt with, then, you know, it was a very chaotic kind of existence, and God was the only stable element through the whole thing. Not that I understood Him right, not that it wasn't full of religious, you know, performance-based kind of framework, but definitely God was very important to me. And even through all the healing process over the last, you know, 52 years or I'll be 52 on Friday, but
happy birthday.
Thank you. Even through all of that, I've never found a place inside of me where I just would turn and be angry at God. I always somehow had the understanding that there was people who were doing stupid things, not God. And now, of course, I was one of the people doing stupid things.
Yeah, but, weren't we all? Was he real to you then? Was he more than just a guy, a concept, a
person?
He was a person to me when I was young, and helped me survive. And by the time I got back to Canada, I basically moved into my intellect. You know, that's where I found it safest. I'm not a very big guy, so, you know, I couldn't move into fisticuffs very well. I'd get the snot beat out of me. But I could use my mouth, and I could use my intelligence. And so God moved much more into a conceptual world rather than a real one, rather than a personal one. And that took a lot of years before God was able to come to my heart rather than just be in my head.
And how did that happen?
That's quite a story. I mean, that's a long story. And it's still happening. So, you know, I've come to believe that God loves the process. He's not particularly interested in any sort of end product the way that we are. It's not like he is doing all these things so he finally gets us to the place where he can finally use us for his purposes. He loves the process because he loves us, and we are in a process. So that process of God breaking through required exactly that, a lot of breaking. And, I mean, my systems for survival were very intact and very obvious if somebody had eyes to see. I was very skilled at speaking and teaching and having that part of my life, the visible part, very together, even though probably two-thirds of my real life was just a total mess. But I could hold it together very well, partly because I was practiced at the intellectual side of things and could defend myself that way.
Well, you came back in your post-teen years and got some Bible training of some kind, didn't you?
Yep, went to Bible school up in Canada, in Saskatchewan, and went to a liberal arts college down in Oregon for a year where I graduated, and then went to seminary also. So I've had a lot of theological background. I worked for churches. I was on missions work. I did all kinds of things within the institutional structure.
I thought it was interesting that Eugene Peterson called you a theologian without knowing anything of your background other than what you
know,
learned in the shack.
I know. I was really surprised by that because it's nothing that we've ever put out there, or I don't talk of myself that way at all.
Yeah, there's nothing I said to him when I put it out there. I just say, there's a guy that's written a pretty compelling book, and I think you'd be blessed to take a look at it. So when he came back with that, I'm going, it's obviously in the concepts you wrestle with and how you explain them in the course of the book, I think it's obvious that you've had a significant amount of not only training there, but then because a lot of it's out-of-the-box kind of thinking. It's not just training, but it's also having rethought a lot of this in your own terminology and your own life.
Yeah, I basically had to rethink everything. And I did it on an intellectual level even a long time before I started doing it at an emotional level in terms of emotional healing or those kinds of things. And part of it, let me tell you, one advantage of being a third culture kid is that you grow up with an ability to look from the outside at a culture. I'll give you an example. Even though I'm born in Canada, you know, I was there for less than a year, and then I go to another culture where I grow up. So that culture really becomes home to me. Then we come back to Canada, and this is supposedly where I'm from. And then I go back to Irian, and now that doesn't seem quite the same anymore. And so then when I come back to Canada, I can't fit into Canada. And if I ever go back to Irian, I don't fit there anymore. And this is one of the big issues with third culture kids. That's a negative in a sense, but the positive of it, part of it is I can cross cultural barriers really easily. I can look at things from the outside where people who've grown up, it's like a fish who's lived their whole life inside water. They have no concept of what water really is. Not that they can think at all, but if they could. And so an American who grows up in the United States, for example, who's lived all their life here, there are things about what they do that seem to me curious. You know, I just don't understand it. I want to ask questions about it. And a lot of those kinds of questions people are sometimes uncomfortable with. So one of the advantages, again, of being a third culture kid is the ability to look from the outside and ask really pertinent questions. And in this culture, one would be, for me, is why is there such an association for people between patriotism and, you know, their national patriotism and their relationship with Jesus? Why this close interlink? Because I don't feel any of that. I don't feel it about Canada. I don't feel it about Irian Jaya. I don't feel it about the U.S. I don't feel, because I was not raised indoctrinated in that kind of a culture, and therefore I don't feel those things.
You mean Jesus isn't a flag waving patriot?
Well, you know, not that I know, and I don't think he'd be an American even if he was.
When you sat down to sort of, you know, leave a legacy for your children of how you sort of thought and saw God, what was it that you were trying to give them? Did you have a sense of that?
Let me tell you the story about how this came about. So Kim's been after me to write this thing, right? So I am I'm working in... At the time we lived quite a ways outside of Gresham, but there's a MAX station in Gresham. And Gresham is a suburb, basically, of Portland. And I was working downtown Portland, so I would take the MAX from Gresham to downtown Portland, which is 40 minutes each way. And so I'd ride on the train, 40 minutes each way every single day. And I figured, well, you know, I've got all this time. I would read, I'd sleep, whatever. So I grabbed some legal pads, and the things that were going through my mind had to do with conversations. In fact, when I first started jotting these down, I thought, well, maybe I can just, for my kids, I call it Conversations with God. And Yellow
Pad. Better than 1,400 things I heard from God.
Yeah. That was hilarious.
Not everyone thought so, but some of us enjoyed.
Oh, that was funny.
Go ahead, sorry.
Anyway, once I'd start those conversations, bringing up a question that I had, it would kind of take on a little life of its own. And I thought, well, this is kind of fun. So 2 years ago now, this May, I sat down at the computer strictly to just load into the computer all these scrappy yellow pieces of paper. And it was kind of getting to me to the point where I'd wake up in the middle of the night with a conversation going on, and I'd grab a piece of paper and write down some notes and then pick it up the next day. I had no story, but I was thinking about, well, you know, one of the things that I really dislike about a lot of the way Jesus is presented, it's very didactic, educational. I've learned probably more from good writers than I've ever learned from any class I've been in. I've had some great teachers, but good writers and good speakers have stimulated me far more than probably, especially sermons, but won't get into that. But I'm thinking, how would my children like to hear these conversations? And I thought, you know, a story has a way of getting past our defenses. It's like we're along for a ride and we're not really participating in the actual conversation, but we're listening to it. And that allows us kind of a third-person experience so that we're not nearly as threatened as if the question is addressed directly to us. So I thought, you know, I'd love to have this inside of a story. And as I started typing in these notes, the story just began to emerge because I needed something around which to have these conversations. And since the elements of conflict that are in especially the first part of the book began to just emerge by themselves. And I started in May. I told you to move all this into the computer. And by August 15th, I was done. I was done the first draft. That's what, 4.5 months. And I tell you, there were some days that this thing, I remember a Saturday, I got up and in 8.5 hours straight, I wrote 4 chapters, and I've never had an experience like that. It was like I had a little house on the edge of the river, and I stepped out the back door, and there was this rushing river coming by, and I put a foot into it and got swept down the river and ended up a number of miles down river. And it was an amazing experience. The last chapter of those four, when you read the book, is chapter 15. And chapter 15, you know, and Wayne and Brad can attest in all the rewriting that we were involved in together, that chapter has never been touched, virtually untouched, since the very first time I wrote it. And
that's what captured me.
Was 15?
Yes, yeah. When you first gave us the manuscript and all the different stuff, there's a lot that did capture me. But the thing that just transported me was what was included there. And I sat there going like, that's when I sat there, I got to get on the plane and I want to go see Mac.
And for those who are diving for your books, that's the chapter called The Festival of Friends. So yeah, if you've read it, you'll know what it is.
Don't skip ahead.
Don't start there.
Yeah,
don't
absolutely not. There. Don't. Yep.
Because here's the reason not to start there, is that, I wept my way through that chapter, and it still just kills me every time I go through it. I mean, there was some things in there for me that were absolutely phenomenal. But that all the rewriting that we've done over the last 18 months or so has been to raise the rest of the book to the level, or close to the level, of chapter 15.
Paul, when you referenced that these were conversations, are these actual conversations you would say you've had with God, or are they more the musings of a lifetime of getting to know Him? Put some context to that.
That's a great question. I would say it's a common...
Okay.
I would say it's a combination of both things, because conceptual thinking, conceptual reality, thinking about my relationship with God, thinking about what's real, what's truthful, has just been such an essential part of my both survival and then my healing. And a lot of musings, but These are real conversations too. I mean, when I was writing those conversations, I was asking the questions, and those were the responses that were definitely coming to those questions. There was, you know, it's kind of a difficult thing to talk about as the author, talking about the fact that yes, I wrote this, but there's so much of this book that, like a friend of my daughter Amy says, is way beyond me. You know, I'm literally, there were times where I would be writing a conversation or typing it into the computer, and the next words were words that I'd never thought of. I mean, the concept was one that, or the way to explain it, I'd never thought of it until I was actually typing it into the computer.
Well, I think there is something of a wonderful touch of, I think, God's presence on this story, this novel. I mean, I think that's what first captured me, is it kind of ushers you into an encounter with God that you weren't really expecting to have.
The biggest central area of my life that was being touched at that moment was to know at the very core of my being how much I was loved by Him. That was, you know, people say, how long did it take you to write it? And I say, 50 years.
Yeah,
and literally, I could not have written this book when I was 48 years old.
Well, early on in this process, I let an author friend of mine, who's written some fairly significant books, have a look at this manuscript. And when he called me up after he'd read it, he said, gosh, I wish I had written this. And I said to him, I said, you know what, I don't think you want the life it would take to write this. And he paused him and he said, I think you're right. Because the pain that comes through, the authenticity of the experiences you've been through, I mean, everything you talked about earlier in the podcast is what shaped how this book comes out. So it really is not something you just, you know, you wrote in four and a half months. Something's been writing over the course of a lifetime through some very severe things that I think caused this book to really ring with authenticity.
The point I want to make is, you know, what kind of road led to this? And it's all grace. I mean, this is a road that is all grace. You have no idea what a difficult person I was to be around during most of my life. I hid it very well, but
we know the nice you.
Yeah.
And we've heard the other stories, but you say grace, and yet it's grace in the middle of some very, very dark places.
Excruciating life.
It's not just, oh, I just was graced and got a book. It was grace in the middle of incredible pain, grace that's brought healing into your own life, you and your wife's, and has sent you guys on a marvelous journey.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are people out there that know what it's like I do, what it's like to come to the edge when there is no hope left, when there is, where you see the hope is gone. And I tell you, I have never been at a worse place or at a scarier place in my life than when I reached the place where I did not have any hope left.
I was just going to say, and where God seems more like an enemy than a friend at those moments. I mean, that sometimes
goes wrong. Or, you know, yeah, and for some people, I think that would be very true. For me, it was like, I deserve this. My level of shame was so deep that I couldn't even get to the place where I could have had any anger toward God or felt like he was an enemy. I mean, I had way too much shame between me and God, wow. Personal shame.
Yep.
And I just couldn't get there.
Wow. Wow, we're going to need to wind this up in a bit. So tell me, why'd you send this thing to me 16 months ago?
Well, I'd sent it to a couple friends, in fact, some family members, to a person, came back and said, this is unbelievable. And that surprised me. So, comes Christmas, Wayne's book comes out, which was the Jake book, right? So I finished the book and I loved it. I really liked it. I liked the story. I liked the concepts that were embedded in it. And so I wrote him an email saying, you know, I loved your book. And by the way, and I know that he gets this fairly often because he told me so. I said, by the way, I've been working on something, and if you had any time to take a look at it, let me know what you think. And this was on a Friday night. And he wrote me a nice email, very polite.
And what was your response?
Very professional.
Well, I just said, you know, I get a lot of this stuff, and I'll take a look at least 25 pages, but, you know, unless I'm captured by it, I can't promise I'll read much more than that. I don't like to get people's hopes up too high.
You know, and I don't know how soon I can get to it, because I've got a stack of stuff on my desk. And
I do today. I've got 15 manuscripts sitting around here to be read.
Exactly. See, and so, and you know what? I had no expectations. I did it because I felt that's what Father wanted, and I was good with that. Whether he ever read it or not, which was fine.
Well, I actually printed out 25 pages and went downstairs later that evening, just thinking I'll read through this real quick and get him written back and get this one off my shelf. And I actually was looking for an excuse not to read it, so I was going to get through 25 pages. But I was so hooked, I kept printing out pages and read it in less than 24 hours. And pretty much what I've told anybody is, you know, so I told you, Gene Peterson, read 25 pages. If you can stop there, don't worry about it. And I haven't found too many people that can stop after 25 pages, because it very much grabs you by the throat and drags you through an incredible story, and left me at the end of it just absolutely in tears. I spent 20 minutes at my dining room table in tears. And what I was in tears about was how great this God was that I had yet to even understand. It was just like he was so much bigger than I knew.
Well, I got him 24 hours later when we were doing another podcast, and he couldn't stop talking about this book. And he just said, you got to read this. And I think for the next series of podcasts, because I must have read it within a couple of days of that, we kept teasing people like we've just, you know, found the best thing since sliced bread.
This became a journey with the three of us really working and reworking. I think at every turn, Brad and I were continually amazed at your humility, willingness to share this baby, let us play with it, let us make some suggestions back to you, and so we're all really thrilled at how it's emerged.
Oh, I am absolutely thrilled, and you know what? I loved the collaborative process that we entered into. It was one of those things that you think, you know, this is how it's supposed to happen. You know, I didn't feel that ownership like I tried to explain earlier, I still don't. You know, everything about this is such grace. It is such a gift. And you guys brought such strength to the table in terms of your own skills, your own backgrounds, how you see things. For example, I can tell, I'll let one secret out, and you'll get this when you're reading the book. But there's a garden scene. And in the original manuscript, the garden itself was a very pristine, proper, English-type garden.
Well organized.
And we were going through this, and Wayne said, you know, I was a little disappointed in the garden. I wasn't expecting a British-type organized garden, but I was expecting more of a wild place. And I thought, you know, that really strikes a chord with me. So I'm going to go back, and I'm going to see what would it look like if it was not that organized thing. Out of that came one of the most powerful chapters in the whole book. It emerged out of that comment. And so that collaborative process to me was an absolutely amazing thing, as well as the ongoing community that is surrounding this book.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's good to have it finally out there and hear some remarks back. Well, thanks for talking to us about it. I'm sure we'll come back and do this. We're going to get some forums up on theshackbook.com so people can discuss the book themselves. And yeah, in a few months from now, maybe we'll get into some kind of Q&A from some of the readers, some of the things we can talk about without ruining the plot for folks that haven't read it yet. So,
yep, I would love to be a part of that. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And again, you two have been absolutely phenomenal in this journey. You've really become brothers of my heart, so thank you.
Well, Paul, thank you for sharing what God has birthed inside you with us so that we could also share it with a much wider audience.
Thanks for traveling with us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd appreciate your comments or your questions by email or at our website, thegodjourney.com. Stop by today and join the conversation.